Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Saeed Hariri, and I am the moderator at Toronto Book Club. Welcome to our 124th session in this rainy Saturday afternoon, and thanks for coming. I know you are anxiously waiting to hear Payam speak, so I'm going to make my introduction very short, I promise. And then he will take us to the land of better world. This evening is hosted by Toronto Book Club. Toronto Book Club is a not-for-profit, non-partisan group formed 12 years ago to facilitate scholarly conversation about contemporary history of Iran. At our monthly sessions, held on second Friday of each month, the scholars and researchers present their latest research with the audience. Again, this is our 124th session, 124th, and I have to offer our deepest gratitude to Payam Khawan, who graciously accepted our invitation to talk about his 2017 Massey lecture. As you know, it is titled In Search of a Better World, and it is number one nonfiction bestseller in Canada. So, Payam Khawan is a professor of international law at McGill University in Montreal and a member of International Court of Arbitration at The Hague. He was formerly a UN war crime prosecutor at The Hague and served with the UN in conflict zones around the world, including Bosnia, Cambodia, Guatemala, and Rwanda. He received his PhD from Harvard Law School, and his previous academic appointments were at Yale Law School, University of Toronto, the European University Institute in Florence, Italy, the University of Paris, and Oxford University. He has appeared as legal counsel in leading cases before the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, the European Court of Human Rights, the Supreme Courts of Canada, and the United States. He's the author of numerous scholarly publications, including Beyond Impunity in the American Journal of International Law, which has been selected as one of the most influential articles in contemporary legal scholarship. His 2017 Massey Lecture, In Search of a Better World, is the number one nonfiction bestseller in Canada. Again, thank you very much, and thanks to York Mills Anglican Church for supporting us in this event. And the books are outside after the talk. Payam will talk for 45, 50 minutes, and then we have maybe 20, 25 minutes for Q&A, and then he will be outside signing the books for us. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming on this rainy afternoon. I'm really grateful to the Toronto Book Club and to my dear friend Saeed Hariri, who together with his wonderful brother Mehrdad are long-standing and loyal and wonderful friends. And I'm also grateful to the York Mills Anglican Church for giving us this beautiful hall for this event. This is actually not far from where I used to live when I first arrived in Canada as a nine-year-old child. And in the Massey lectures, I decided to tell the story of human rights through memoir, which is also a call for action, because I believe that it's our intimate experiences that make us understand the importance of struggling for justice. And human dignity, human rights are meaningless as abstractions. And in particular, my very basic thesis was that felt experience is the fountain of all knowledge. Until we feel injustice, we can never understand the importance of justice. Now, that simple proposition I knew would be met with ridicule by the educated cynics in my circle, which was exactly my point. about why it is that the liberal elites who say all the right things are losing the masses to the demagogues and the extremists that are pushing all the right psychological buttons, but for all the wrong reasons. And I think it's because the liberal elites, a metaphor of that could be the Davos Club, the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, which I speak about in my last chapter, really is looking at the world from 30,000 feet and peddling in righteous platitudes, but is entirely indifferent to the immense reality of suffering in our midst. So I decided that in order to convey the reality of human rights, it's necessary to tell stories. Now, telling stories may seem really rather trite, straightforward, but in academic circles, it's a cutting-edge concept. It's called narrativization. And as soon as you call it narrativization, it shows that you're really smart and you have some great theoretical approach. But, you know, the indigenous cultures have been telling stories for a very long time. And what's fascinating is that one of the cutting-edge theories, which is feminist epistemology, some of you may be familiar with the work of Carol Gilligan, teaches us that women in particular, if one has a sort of gendered perspective, tend to see the world more through relations as opposed to abstractions. So whether we call it feminist epistemology, so it seems really cutting edge, or we simply call it storytelling, as in Shahrazad's 1001 Nights, ultimately, it's these narratives which allow us to connect emotionally to the reality of human beings and what it means to struggle, sometimes in the face of the unthinkable, to reclaim your humanity when confronted with injustice. So coming back to this neighborhood, which is where I first saw Canada as a nine-year-old, the world, of course, looked very different from the vantage point of a nine-year-old. I didn't understand why we had to leave our wonderful country where I had all my friends and toys, and I had a wonderful cat even, which I didn't want to leave behind. So I was really not happy to be coming to Canada. And I remember being told that, oh, you don't want to go there. Everyone lives in igloos and all sorts of ideas. So here I was, arriving here, speaking just a few words of English, and I was fascinated by this new country, but at the same time, longing to go back to my home. So this was not a kind of happy immigrant story of, you know, someone that came here in search of a better life, but in a sense, we were preemptive refugees. We left Iran before we were forced to leave, because as members of the persecuted Baha'i minority, my parents had the foresight to know that if there was ever any political turmoil, we as the scapegoats would be the first one to go. And that was a very accurate prediction of what happened in the coming year. So in a sense, we left in style, whereas a lot of other people had to leave through harrowing journeys through the mountains, to Turkey, through the desert, across Baluchistan to Pakistan. And from the vantage point of a child, I remember the kind of things that left an impression on me. I'd never seen color television. I was fascinated to see color television, to realize that instead of the two boring channels which we had in Iran, which were either the news or some soap opera that made my grandmother cry, we had all sorts of, you know, wonderful programs. There were so many choices. And I was amazed to realize that John Wayne, other than speaking Persian, also spoke English, because I'd only heard him speak Persian. There were many sort of elements of cultural adaptation. I was fascinated that Canadians obeyed traffic regulations. It was, to me, very highly unnatural. There was a kind of clarity to the survival of the fittest on the streets of Tehran, where, you know, right of way was determined by the size of the vehicle. I was obviously impressed also by the shopping malls. I remember the first trip with my parents to the shopping mall. They were all so luxurious, but I was really dumbfounded why the cashiers at Canadian Tire refused to haggle over the price of goods. So it was a kind of work in progress, becoming Canadian, coming to a new country, in a sense, leaving part of yourself behind, and then trying to reimagine your own identity. And it wasn't always difficult. In those days, Iranians were still exotic. Those were long before the days of Tehranto. And it was very difficult, you know, being one of, you know, two brown children in the schoolyard, especially during the time of the Islamic Revolution and the sort of spectre of terrorism and hostage taking and everything else for which I became personally answerable in the schoolyard. So I realized very early on this reality, which I would call the prison of identity, where you don't belong really anywhere. You don't belong in your own country because you are a hated minority, persecuted minority, and then you come to a new country and you realize that you're not necessarily welcome there either. So you try to mediate some sort of identity. And one of the things that you begin to realize is that belonging isn't so much about a physical place as it is about an emotional space. And that is something that I wish to explore today, because the two themes that I try to explore in my book, the first is the reality of the oneness of humankind, our inextricable oneness as a single race inhabiting a single planet, and the consequences which that has had on our self-conception, our idea of identity and belonging. And how, in a sense, the rise of extremism, whether it's, you know, the jihadist violence that we see with, you know, Daesh halfway across the world, or the rise of the white supremacists and the extremists on the other side of the world, that there's something profoundly similar against what I call the hissy fit of xenophobic hissy fit of identity warriors, that the rise of extremism, in a sense, is because of the emergence of a world civilization, the emergence of a transcendent global identity, which challenges our self-conception and identity in unprecedented ways. For the first time in history, really, we're forced to imagine our identities through inclusivity rather than exclusivity. There has been a collapse, not just of physical boundaries, but more importantly, of psychological boundaries, which has created a disequilibrium and a kind of yearning to go back to what was once familiar. So I'd like to explore that a bit and to speak about how I see the anatomy, if you like, of conflicts of identity, which is one of the main plagues confronting the world today. I also explore in the book the idea of human rights in a world of extremes. In the final chapter of the book, not to spoil it for you, but that final chapter begins with, "I miss my mother." It's not what I expected to hear from a suicide bomber, which is a conversation I had in the summer of 2016 with a gentleman named Ahmed, a teenage suicide bomber who was captured by the Kurdish Peshmerga forces trying to cross from the Syrian border into Iraq. He was now a prisoner, and I had a remarkable conversation with him, which was incredibly illuminating, trying to understand what it takes to take a young man who had dreams and ambitions and to become a suicide bomber. So when I spoke with Ahmed, he was telling me, of course, the ideology that he'd been brainwashed with, that, you know, there's only one Allah and all the enemies of Islam must be destroyed, and the enemies were a very, very long list. So he was basically repeating to me this sort of narrative that he had been brainwashed with. And after we finished the conversation, I let him say whatever he wanted. I sort of said, "Well, I'm leaving now. Do you have anything else to say?" And the prison guards came to take him back to his cell. So he stopped and he said, "I miss my mother. If I could do it all over again, I would go to school and become a doctor." And that was a remarkably eye-opening statement to hear from him. I mean, he was dangerous, don't get me wrong. He was very dangerous because of all the things that he had been subjected to and how he'd been brainwashed. But at the same time, I felt sorry for him. I felt sorry for him. And I asked myself, what had turned Ahmed the healer into Ahmed the killer? Why would a teenager with ambitions and dreams be turned into someone who's willing to take his own life and the life of others in the name of what he obviously considers to be good? And one of the things we realize looking at history is that radical evil is always committed in the name of something good. People that do really evil things don't think they're being evil. And that's another sort of theme that I wish to explore. For the most part, every great act of destruction, genocide, is committed in the name of a greater good. So I reflected on how this teenage sitting in the prison in Duhok could just as well have been a teenager in a shopping mall here in Canada, texting his girlfriend on his iPhone, and instead of fighting a holy war, he would be fighting boredom. And I tried to make the connection between the idea of human dignity in a world of extremes. When we live in this exceptionally privileged, prosperous country named Canada, what is our connection with and responsibility in relation to what happens beyond our shores, and how does that affect our self-conception, our identity, and the values that we espouse? So just a few sort of highlights, I suppose, of this narrative. Getting back to my days here in Canada, I was a typical immigrant teenager trying to fit in. These were the days of Michael Jackson. I was trying to perfect my moonwalking skills, which were rather appalling. I committed a number of fashion crimes. It's a good thing there was no Facebook in those days to record items of clothing that I experimented with. That's a trauma best forgotten. So I was just a teenager. I was trying to fit in. I was trying to be cool. I was trying to be popular in high school. And then at 16 years of age, my 16-year-old contemporary by the name of Mona Mahmoud Nejad, a member of the Baha'i community from Shiraz, writes an essay in high school. And in that essay, she speaks about the persecution of the Baha'is in Iran, and she demands her freedom of conscience. She demands her freedom of belief. So she writes what is, in effect, a critical essay in a country where writing such an essay can carry grave consequences. Mona was arrested, she was put in prison, she was subject to horrific torture, and by June of 1983, she and nine other women in Shiraz, who were all Baha'is, were hanged. Now, when news of that execution reached me, and this was after many other members of the Baha'i community had been subject to what was, in effect, an extermination campaign. And many loved ones, my parents are here, they had many dear friends and family who also were affected by this horrific campaign of violence. All of a sudden, that sort of world of innocence became shattered. But more than anything, as a teenager in Canada, in this bubble of incredible privilege, I was forced to ask myself the question of why her and not me? A basic question that we need to ask ourselves when we hear these stories of suffering in the world. What was the difference between Mona and I? Well, the difference is my family migrated to Canada and she stayed behind in Iran. It was totally random why she had to pay for her beliefs with her life, while I had the privilege of living this incredibly comfortable life. So I was forced to ask myself the basic question of, well, what is my freedom worth if it's wasted on selfish mediocrity? What does it mean to be freedom. We celebrate our freedom in Canada. But what does it really mean to have the opportunities that we have? So that was the beginning of a journey where you come to a crossroads, where you witness injustice in a very intimate way. It's no longer a distant abstraction. It's not a bleep on the evening news where you hear in between, you know, the Hollywood celebrity gossip and the ice hockey scores and whatever the case may be, that, you know, somewhere in some country there's been a conflict and a lot of people have been killed. So that experience clothed injustice with meaning for me. And at a very young age, I was forced to choose either to turn my back and ignore what I had seen or to do something about it. And that was the beginning of my journey, which is why the subtitle of the book is called Human Rights Odyssey. So I decided that if the youth in Iran were being killed for writing an essay, then it would be utterly shameful if I did not commit my life to fighting for justice. And I say this because I think in our culture of what Max Weber famously called Occidental rationalism, the whole idea of modernity, the idea of knowledge, Max Weber called it disenchantment, that the price of modernity is disenchantment with a mystical religious universe. And that is part of the trajectory of the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and it's fascinating to be discussing that sitting in a church. But one of the conceptions of modernity and progress was the idea of rationalization, that the world could be reduced to a set of utilitarian equations, that the truth could affect be reduced to the manageable confines of theories and scientific thought, and that technology would liberate humankind from the darkness and backwardness of the past. So by the time of the Second World War, the myth of modernity's progress had been shattered. Because in the Second World War, which followed the First World War, which followed the Stalinist purges, which followed the Napoleonic Wars, a century of horrific violence, which made the religious wars of Europe from the medieval ages pale in comparison, we realized that modernity had a dark side, and that dark side is that all that we have done is to take our base instincts, our capacity for hatred and violence, and magnified it through technological advancement, which now allowed us to commit mass murder with a remarkable efficiency. So the idea of human rights emerged as a result of those unprecedented calamities. Humankind was shocked into rethinking the idea of Occidental rationalism. And by 1948, when the UN Declaration of Human Rights was adopted, it began with the premise that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity. Now, we would all agree with that proposition, and indeed, that is the foundation of our identity as Canadians. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is our constitution, which is the fundamental value, the glue that keeps together an otherwise heterogeneous multicultural society, is founded on the idea that the purpose of society, purpose of the rule of law, is the preservation of human dignity. Human dignity, I would submit, is hardly a scientific concept. I would even go further and say that it is hardly empirically verifiable. Gibbons, in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, one of the great works of history, observed that history is about the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. Much of history is about rape, pillage, and murder. Much of history is about the right of the victor to enslave and exterminate the vanquished. So when we today are horrified when we see the images of the Syrian refugees, the atrocities being committed against the Rohingya, or wherever else in the world we witness all of these disturbing images, We should remember that the idea that human beings shouldn't be treated that way is a revolutionary concept in historical terms. 1948, it's less than 70 years ago. So the idea of human rights is a remarkable revolution in our conception of the purpose of civilization, because this was a universal declaration adopted by all the nations of the world. And at the same time, it is a return to a mystical conception of human nature, because one could equally, from an intellectual point of view, argue that human beings are incorrigibly selfish and aggressive, and the idea of human dignity is completely a fiction. And in one's moments of pessimism and despair, indeed, that is an idea that may seem very appealing. So I speak about this because what I witnessed as I decided to commit my life to fighting for human rights, as I went to Harvard Law School and I went to the United Nations and all these elite institutions where I looked at the world from 30,000 feet and tried to reconcile the intimate reality of suffering, is that we say the right things, but we fail to act when it matters. And we've created this sort of self-delusion that we are virtuous, but that we don't have to pay a price for our beliefs. And I'm going to return to that shortly to explain the consequences of that, what I would consider emotional and spiritual disconnect between the ideals that we espouse and the reality that they demand of us in terms of our lifestyles, our choices, and so on and so forth. So in the 1990s, I became, by accident, being in the right place at the right time, or perhaps the wrong place at the wrong time, I became the first legal advisor at the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague during the Yugoslav War. And that was one of my first introductions to how the world looks from the ivory tower as opposed to what it looks like at ground zero. So I was working with the United Nations in Bosnia. The Cold War had ended. Francis Fukuyama had written The End of History. The idea was that Western liberalism and the market economy would sweep the planet, and from Vancouver to Vladivostok, we would have an era of peace and prosperity. That's what everyone thought in 1991 when the Soviet Union disintegrated. All of a sudden, the Yugoslav War became a kind of rude awakening. It spoiled the post-Cold War euphoria. And the spectre of ethnic cleansing and genocide, the siege of Sarajevo, the use of systematic rape, the mass graves, the concentration camps, these became shocking for a Western world that imagined that all of these horrors were part of a remote past that would never again be repeated. Samuel Huntington, famous professor at Harvard, who's no longer with us, wrote The Clash of Civilizations, now a kind of common expression that is used very often. He wrote The Clash of Civilizations in 1993 in order to describe what was happening in the Bosnian War. His idea basically was that since the world is no longer divided between the two rival ideologies of, you know, Western liberalism and Soviet communism, the new fault lines would become the divisions between civilizations. So for him, it was natural that in Bosnia, the Bosnian Muslims and Bosnian Serbs and Bosnian Croats would be killing each other, because that's what people with different identities do. And there was a fault line between the Ottoman Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is where sort of Bosnia became a pawn that was fought over between these two empires. So for him, it was natural that these different groups would be killing each other. Now, Clash of Civilizations today has become an extremely controversial but popular concept, although it is entirely absurd nonsense. Now, why is it nonsense? Because Professor Huntington, sitting in the academy, had never bothered to to come and talk to people on the streets of Sarajevo, where every other person I met came from a mixed marriage. Statistically, half of all marriages in Bosnia were mixed. Bosnia had a long tradition of religious tolerance. During the Spanish Inquisition, the Jews and the Albigensian Christians would flee and come to Sarajevo because it was known as a place of tolerance. And when you go to the old Turkish bazaar in Sarajevo, you see a church and a mosque and a synagogue, a city of eclectic harmony. And I was astonished that this man, who is an intellectual luminary, would be writing this when he is not bothered to read a single book about the history of the former Yugoslavia, or at the very least, to talk to a couple of people from Bosnia. And I began to realize that what we put forward as knowledge, and in particular, many of the very cynical worldviews that we have, which gain currency among decision makers who then act on those false concepts and decide, for example, that yes, ethnic partition is the only path of coexistence in Bosnia because people with different identities are always going to kill each other. So these ideas have real consequences. They're not just subject of idle academic dispute. I realized that much of what elites say about the world is completely disconnected with reality, and that very often it is highly destructive. Now, in Rwanda, which was the next place I served with in the UN, I learned another powerful lesson. In 1994, during a three-month period, up to 1 million people were killed in Rwanda, and the victims of the genocide were predominantly members of the Tutsi minority. What is remarkable about what happened in Rwanda is that it was like a televised Holocaust. A year before the Rwandan genocide, President Clinton had gone to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, where he had said, never again will we allow such horrors to happen. Well, a year later, never again became ever again, as it had in so many other instances in Guatemala, in Cambodia, the many countries where I worked with the UN. And while we were happy to indulge in Holocaust remembrance and to condemn the distant atrocities of the Nazis, we did not want to connect this delusional sense of virtue with the reality of the responsibility that we have to intervene against the Holocausts that are happening today in our own midst. But what was remarkable about Rwanda was not just the staggering scale of the genocide, the fact that the UN withdrew its peacekeepers because there was nothing strategically interesting in Rwanda, no oil, no minerals, nothing that would make it worthwhile to try and save the life of 1 million innocent people. What was remarkable is how easily the genocide could have been prevented. And allow me to elaborate. Rwanda was, at the time, one of the poorest countries in Africa. Today, it's actually become quite a prosperous country. It's doing quite well economically. At the time, there was a 70% illiteracy rate, and 90% of the population lived in rural areas. The killing rate of almost 800,000 people in 3 months is 2 to 3 times the efficiency of the Nazi concentration camps. So how was it possible in a poor country, which is largely rural with dispersed populations, to achieve this extraordinary efficiency? Well, the weapon of mass destruction was a radio station called RTLM, Radio-Télévision Libre des Mille Collines. It was the only source of information for the vast majority of people who spoke only Kenya, Rwanda, who couldn't read, who had no access to any source of information. And through the incitement to hatred, over several months, the radio station succeeded in pitting neighbor against neighbor. It's famously said that the Holocaust didn't begin in the gas chambers, it began with words. And I began to understand the power of words, the power of how we construct the world to have very, very real consequences, both good and bad. And I mention this because, as horrible as Rwanda was, It taught me a powerful lesson that there's nothing inevitable about radical evil. We treat radical evil as if it's a natural disaster, like an earthquake or a tsunami. Last night, I was at a fundraising event for the Rohingya Muslims, and I reminded people that the Rohingya are not victims of a natural disaster. They're victims of a man-made disaster. There is someone, or not one person, but there is a group of people that is committing these atrocities, and they're doing so on a very organized and systematic scale, and they are benefiting from it politically and economically and otherwise. So when we begin to understand that radical evil is not a natural disaster, but it's a choice, it's a political choice, that identity is an instrument by which very often people in distress, in a state of chaos and confusion, are given a false certainty, the oldest trick in the book for every fascist demagogue, including in our own societies, which I'm going to turn to towards the end, that we realize the power of words, we realize the power of our own conversations, the power of our own choices, because ultimately these great evils aren't just imposed from above. They have to take root among the masses. And if the masses have a deep understanding of the oneness of humankind, of the artificiality of all of these constructed identities that divide us, well, then the demagogues are not able to carry them down the road to hell so easily. After about a decade of working in various war zones and seeing all of these horrible atrocities, I decided that I had had enough. Now, back then, PTSD wasn't fashionable yet. No one was talking about it at the UN. They just kind of tossed us in the middle of all these places. And, you know, as a 20-something-year-old lawyer, you had to deal with it. So I went into a very, very dark place. And I decided that I've had enough. I began to hate the victims. I began to say, they've ruined my life. It's not my problem. Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Cambodia, it's not my problem. I'm going to go and I'm going to become a corporate lawyer in New York. And I'm going to make a lot of money. I'm going to give my family a wonderful life. And the birth of my son was an epiphany. My son was born in The Hague. And I took one look at him, you know, the miracle of life. And I realized that I've been dealing with death for much too long. Now I'm going to live. So I went to New York. And I worked in a very prestigious law firm. I had a beautiful office on a skyscraper with a magnificent view of Manhattan. And on September 11th, my wonderful parents, who are sitting here today, together with my 2-year-old boy and his mom, were on their way to the World Trade Center. They were on the way to the World Trade Center, and the telephone lines were down. So for several hours, I dialed and I dialed and I dialed, and I wondered if my family was dead or alive. And I never imagined that I would witness that scale of violence in New York. After all, I'd left all of those suffering, bleeding nations because I'd had enough. And now it was my family. I couldn't just get into the UN helicopter and say, goodbye, I feel very sorry for you. It was my next door neighbor's husband who had died with an 8-month pregnant wife. So that was a shocking experience for me. And the day before, on September 10, I was reading an essay by my friend Mohsen Makhmalbaf, you know him, a very well-known filmmaker, who had made a film called Kandahar. And of course, he's in the style of cinema vérité, so he goes and he makes films with ordinary people. And the power of Kandahar is that he had filmed it with a group of Afghan refugees. And it showed the stark reality of suffering in Afghanistan at a time when most people had no idea there is a place called Afghanistan. He talks about a film festival where someone asked him, "What is Afghanistan?" So he was really upset because no one cared about his film, no one cared about the message of suffering, the incredible suffering of the Afghans, the killings, the starvation. Until in March of that year, the Taliban went and destroyed the beautiful Buddhas of Bamiyan, the twin Buddhas. And then there was an outrage in the world at the destruction of these beautiful cultural objects. So Mohsen was saying, how is it that the horrifying suffering of the people raises barely any concern, but the destruction of the Buddhas creates such an uproar? And he wrote in his essay that the Buddhas were not destroyed, they crumbled out of shame, that their greatness could do no good. Now, his essay was called The Limbs of No Body, or The Limb That Has Been Cut Off from the Body of Humankind. Those of us from Iranian background will know the famous poem of Saadi, a medieval poet from Shiraz, who wrote, and there are many different translations, but one translation is that people, all human beings, are members of one whole, created in essence of one soul. So this was the poem of Saadi, where he spoke about interdependence. He said, we are all interdependent, and the suffering of one part will inevitably affect the suffering of others. And he goes on to say that if you cannot feel the pain of others, you don't have the right to call yourself a human being. Now, when he wrote this poem in the 13th century, it was a beautiful, romantic, poetic vision. But at that moment, when I wondered if my family was dead or alive, I thought about that poem, which incidentally is inscribed on a beautiful Persian carpet, which hangs outside the portal of the UN General Assembly. And I always wonder how many of the decision makers that go into the UN bother to maybe read that poem and understand it. And while the world was talking about the clash of civilizations, all I could think about was interdependence, not the clash of civilizations. All I could think about is that all of these sordid, cynical geopolitical games that were played between the Soviets and the West at the expense of the Afghan people throughout the Cold War, when they were used as a pawn, when the Soviets invaded and slaughtered the Afghan people, when the Americans, with the help of the Saudis and the Pakistanis, were training the jihadists and unleashing their fury against the Soviet Union, and how, when the Soviet Union collapsed, these brilliant strategic thinkers, the Brzezinskis of the world and the Kissingers of the world, whatever, basically said, well, we can wash our hands clean of Afghanistan. We have no more use for the people there. Guess what? It's going to come back and blow up in your face. When you leave a country that has been so profoundly traumatized through a decade of mass murder, which is filled with well-trained, well-equipped, jihadist, traumatized warriors that you yourself have trained, and you just say, goodbye, it's been nice knowing you. What kind of a person would call that political realism? Because that's what we were told all the time. You must be realistic. Well, that is the greatest act of political unrealism, because in an interdependent world, that is going to come back and haunt you. So when I look at the divisive ideologies, which in at least the tradition of the European Enlightenment became a substitute for Christianity, we went from the decline of religion to the creation of substitute religions, ideologies. Communism, with Stalin as one of its great apostles, racism, with Nazism as one of the manifestations, nationalism. So all we did was to stop killing each other in the name of religion and start killing each other in the name of some other contrived identity, but to do so with far greater efficiency and technological sophistication. So the trajectory of history teaches us that we came to the realization that we need a United Nations, that we need to have universal concept of human rights, that we need global governance, that we need to understand that there is a common interest that affects all nations. We came to that realization at an incredibly high price. And all the divisive ideologies and their remnants today, narrow conceptions of national self-interest, the interests of elites at the expense of the many, all of these are going to come back and haunt us. Because the reality is that of our inextricable oneness. Oneness is not some lofty, naive, unrealistic idea, as many of the diplomats and others would tell me. I remember when I came to the UN as an intern, I was so idealistic, and one of these, I think, bureaucrats that had been there a bit too long looked at me and said, "Son, let me tell you, you need three things to survive the UN: geritol, alcohol, and protocol." And I realized working in the UN that he wasn't joking. So there is this incredible cynicism which passes as realism, which justifies short-sighted, divisive manipulations, which in the end come back time and again to haunt us. So when we look at what's happening in the world today, whether it's climate change, Syrian refugees, ISIS, Daesh, the plight of indigenous people in our own backyard, and one could just go on, let us not imagine that there is not a chain of colossally stupid decisions that ultimately ended up creating those evils. These are all choices that were made, and in particular, when we decide that our welfare is separate from that of others, that we can pursue our own narrow, selfish interests, indifferent to the suffering in our own midst, never mind the immorality of that decision, in the world of today, that is an entirely unrealistic proposition. Which brings me to the last comment that I wish to make, which goes back to our own bubble here in Canada, in the life of incredible privilege that we live in. And I say this as someone who, as I said, the project, the ongoing work in progress of becoming Canadian. I think when Canadians are ungrateful, they need to go and live abroad for a while and come back, and they'll become much more patriotic. And I learned the immense beauty and value of this society exactly because I left for a number of years and saw how incredibly blessed we are, not just because of the sort of physical, natural sort of blessings that we have, but of the model of sort of a post-national identity that we're trying to create with human rights at the core of our self-conception. But I also realized that there is something absurd about the fact that in our society of plenty, we have a pandemic of stress, anxiety, and depression. We live in the midst of a mental health crisis. I was talking to my friends from the CBC who had done a story about how fish in the Niagara River have alarming levels of antidepressants in their system. You know what happens is because the wildlife people are looking at the fish and they're wondering why they're getting eaten by their predators because they're a bit too happy with whatever Zoloft and I forget what the other ones are called. So imagine the staggering scale of the use of antidepressants in our society, of unbelievable privilege. So I began to try to connect the question of our spiritual reality, which is, I think, what it addresses, to the social struggles and political transformation that we need in order to achieve the better world that we all dream about. Which brings me back to the disconnect that we have between paying lip service to worthy causes and our unwillingness to pay a price. We want to feel virtuous, but we don't want to pay a price. So that summer when I was in northern Iraq in the Kurdish refugee camps with these Yazidi girls, Badia and Bushra, two sisters who were abducted at age 12 and 13, enslaved and violated sexually by the Daesh warriors, horrible stories. So I come back from that camp. It was 50 degrees Celsius in Baghdad that summer. You can imagine what the camps were like. These young people traumatized just sitting there in those camps. So I came back to Ottawa, and in the House of Commons there was a debate. The debate was whether to call what happened to the Yazidi a genocide or not. It became a mud-throwing contest between the opposition and the government, each accusing the other of not sorry, feeling sorry for the victims, while appropriating to itself a sort of a condescending sense of virtue. Look at us, we feel so sorry for the victims. And in the midst of this debate back and forth, we're talking about how Daesh is chopping off people's head, how it's barbaric, how it must be condemned. Someone put her hand up. Well, not, you don't put your hand up in House of Commons, you speak in turn, and said, I want to ask, why is it that we are selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which also chops people's heads off, for crimes such as witchcraft, such as sorcery? And then all of a sudden there was this silence. The opposition and the government all of a sudden found common cause. So in politics, principles go to the highest bidder. There's a reason why we don't want to have the bigger conversation about what is the root cause of these evils that bring these desperate people to our shores. Because the Yazidi that I spoke with, none of them wanted to come as refugees. They said, we want to go back. We want to go back to our villages, our beautiful farms and orchards and our lives. But we have no choice. So where is this disease of violent extremism, which today is ripping the Middle East apart as Iran and Saudi Arabia vie for supremacy, as the Brits and the Americans and the Canadians and how many others are more than happy to sell billions of dollars of weapons to turn a blind eye to these ideologies of hatred and extremism, which are merely instrumentalized identities. That's all they are. That's all they are. These are incredibly complex, multi-ethnic, multi-religious societies that for centuries have lived side by side. So it made me realize that there's actually a connection, first of all, between our choices and what we witness happening in the world. But more importantly, that there's a connection between our materialistic, money-worshipping, consumerist culture and our sense of despair and grief, our mental health crisis. There's a connection between that and our unwillingness to connect emotionally with suffering in the world and to commit our lives to doing better. When we fight for justice, we're not doing anybody a favor. We're nobody's savior except our own. We're doing nothing except retrieving our own authenticity, discovering our own spiritual reality. When we talk about human dignity, yes, the Charter of Rights speaks about human dignity in a legalistic way, and we go to the Supreme Court of Canada if someone's human rights are violated, and so on and so forth. But as a cultural phenomenon, when we believe that human beings are, in their innermost essence, noble beings, then how can we reconcile that with this crass, money-loving, self-indulgent culture, which has poisoned our planet, brought us to the brink of ecological disaster, and created an absurd situation where we consume more and more, but we're less and less happy? So some people may accuse me of having become the Dr. Phil of the human rights world. I plead guilty as charged, because I think that there is an intimate connection between our spiritual sort of consciousness, our willingness to connect at a deep level with human suffering, to assume personal responsibility. There's an intimate connection between that and the failure of our social movements and politics to transcend the divisive, hypocritical ways which create the illusion of progress but actually don't change anything. I was astonished. Just imagine this. Angelina Jolie, wearing a beautiful two-piece outfit. Another Hollywood celebrity with a $30,000 Hermes Birkin bag on a red carpet. The flashes of the cameras. It's all beautiful. It's all glamorous. What is the event? It's an event on victims of sexual violence and armed conflict. It was the global summit which focused on the victims of rape in the Congo in 2015, with the British Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary competing to fawn over Angelina and the other celebrities. It cost the British taxpayer £5 million. Almost nothing was given to the NGOs on the ground in Congo actually helping the girls that were the victims of this horrific rape. And there was no discussion about why has Congo become a failed state. Has it something to do with the pillage of the resources of that country throughout the decades? So we don't want to ask those questions because it's going to spoil the party. We just want to feel virtuous. But we're feeling virtuous by exploiting the suffering of other people. That's what we're doing. So if we're brutally honest with ourselves, if we stop lying to ourselves individually and collectively and genuinely ask the question, what can I do to make a difference? I think we would transform the world. And I think all of us are part of that equation. The personal is the political. The choices that we make in the conversations that we have across our dinner table, at our places of work, the choices that we make in how we live our lives, these ultimately reflect the world that we see around us. The good and the bad is nothing more than the choices that we've made. I will end with just one small story, which I think explains how we underestimate the power of the everyday. We underestimate the power of our own empathy and engagement. It's the story of Donovan Fontaine, chief of the Saking Nation in Winnipeg, who in 2011, when Prime Minister Harper issued an apology for the Indigenous residential schools as part of a legal settlement, which set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he heard a knock at his door, and he opened the door. And on that day, of course, this story was all over the news, the reality that generations of children were ripped away from the arms of their children, from their mothers and fathers and communities, and sent to residential schools where they were subject to abuse, and the catastrophic toll that that has had through intergenerational trauma in our Indigenous communities, where incidentally 40% of children live under the poverty line, something we should be outraged about as Canadians, that in our country we have this horrible, horrible suffering. The knock at his door was an elderly couple that was next door neighbors. He opens the door, he sees them holding a plate of muffins. And they say, "We had no idea about what your people have gone through. We just want to tell you that we're sorry." And this man, who is a very sophisticated, highly educated, influential figure, told me that that simple gesture of kindness had such a profound effect on his healing. So changing the world isn't about going to the UN Security Council and peddling a bunch of nonsense and adopting this or that resolution. It begins with the choices that we make. It begins with asking ourselves, do we really care? Not mindful of virtue wanting award and recognition, but in the silence of our own conscience, do we really care? Or are we going to choose to remain indifferent? I'm very sorry for going on for so long. I will end here, and thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Payam. Questions? We have a mic here. If I could ask those who have questions, please line up. We hear that Islamic State is falling apart and the fighters are going back to wherever they came from. And I just heard on the news the other day that some of the countries have decided to kill these fighters on the ground to basically stop them from coming back. Australia and England were named on CBC News. What do you think, what goes through your mind when you hear that these people are coming back and, you know, what's the solution?
Well, that's a very easy question to answer, isn't it? Well, there is no easy answer. That's my answer. There is no easy answer because it's taken us an incredibly long and sordid affair to get into this mess. So digging ourselves out of it will equally be very difficult. And the reality is that you have all of these extremist, traumatized, highly dangerous young people who could come back into our societies and commit acts of terrorism. But on the other hand, the reality is that I don't think we've seen the end of the phenomena which is represented mm-hmm. by ISIS. Mm-hmm. And, while Daesh was very forthcoming about broadcasting its atrocities on social media, which is probably why they get disproportionate impact, the other militia, including the Shia militia in Iraq, are no better. The Shia militia have massacred lots and lots of civilians, and the root causes of what allowed Daesh to recruit those people has not been removed either. So it's not that people just woke up one day and said, I want to go and start chopping off people's heads. There were a whole series of events which led to that. So I think that the bigger picture here is as I said, Iran and Saudi Arabia are locked into the same kind of colossally stupid balance of power politics that the Europeans had for two world wars until they learned better. And that's why I said there is a historical lesson to be learned. The lesson is that of interdependence is a reality. Sooner or later in the Middle East, we're going to have a common market from Tel Aviv to Tehran, from Damascus to Dubai. That is the force of history. Mm-hmm. That is the force of history. Now, the question is, how are we going to get there? So the interesting thing is that while both Iran and Saudi Arabia are using the discourse of traditional identities and Islam and this kind of nativist ideology, in reality, they're playing out modern European history. They're blindly following the exact experience of nation building that brought Europe to its knees in 1945. Now, the question is, how much destruction will have to take place before they reach a stage? Because this is not going to end well. The idea that you can project your power through violent extremism, except on a very short-term basis, is completely unsustainable.
Thank you. If I could ask, please, to limit your questions to maximum 1 minute, please.
First of all, thank you so much for your wonderful, inspiring lecture. And thank you for your patience with my English in advance. I admire your courage to allow yourself vulnerable because being so conscientious and empathetic, makes your work hard. I'm talking about PTSD, and I'm concerned about your mental health. So, how did you cope with it, and how are you coping with it? And one more question is that has being that empathetic ever made your job difficult as being a prosecutor? Thank you.
Okay. I think that life is a learning process, and throwing yourself in the middle of a war zone is an extreme learning process. So yes, I tend to be on the reckless end of the spectrum. It doesn't take much imagination to figure it out. So I learned the hard way that you have to have boundaries, and that you can't be, Don Quixote chasing the windmills, trying to, put out all the fires of the world. So it's one thing we learn when we grow up and, hopefully become a bit wiser. So I think it's very important to understand your own limits, and more important to understand that struggling for justice is not a case of instant gratification. It's a long and painful struggle. You don't end world hunger by a summer internship, which is what some of my students think, right? They become disappointed because over a summer they don't, solve all the problems of the world. So we've lost the art of patience and silent contemplation and painful struggle. So that's one of the things I've realized, that you need to take care of yourself spiritually in order to be an effective agent of change. And if you don't nourish your soul, then you're not going to make it. And what I find fascinating, getting back to the indigenous experience, is the understanding of spirituality as a way of healing wounds. And I was recently at the National Inquiry for Murdered and Missing Indigenous Girls and Women in Winnipeg, and I was amazed by how the language which they're using as part of the process of healing for these deeply wounded communities is all about the language of spirituality and the profound understanding that this culture has of wholeness, what it means for us to heal and to feel whole. And then finally, your question about empathy as a prosecutor. Well, yes, you need, as a professional, to understand the boundaries of what it is that you're doing. But empathy doesn't mean that you compromise professionalism. It simply means that you situate your profession and skills in a wider social context. You ask yourself, what is the significance and value of what I'm doing? So I'm not telling people that they shouldn't learn to become whatever doctors, lawyers, therapists, whatever it is someone does, but to ask, how does this fit into the broader search for a human betterment and lasting, meaningful change?
You made the comment, we say the right things but fail to act. As soon as you said that, I think you win. Is there any way you can paint for us a realistic picture of what is absolutely positively possible at the UN?
You know, I think the UN is a very important part of the equation, but not as important as we think. And if it became, if I sort of succeeded in conveying my view, I think grassroots transformation is the only lasting transformation. At the end of the day, the UN is composed of diplomats and bureaucrats and experts, of elites that represent certain interests and agendas. So in a sense, they're the tip of the iceberg. So if we create societies that are built on greed, hatred, and all these, you know, base instincts, ultimately that's going to find its way into the discourse of the United Nations, into the way in which states articulate their narrow interests. There's a lot of good that has happened at the UN, but it has happened at a very high cost. For example, war. We take for granted that today, believe it or not, we're living in the most non-violent era of history. Until the Second World War, war was, to quote von Clausewitz, the German historian, the continuation of foreign policy by other means. Nations went to war all the time to solve their disputes. Today, war is a relatively rare phenomenon. And even the violence that we see in the world is exaggerated for two reasons. One is because of the internet and satellite television and the means of communication. Two generations ago, we simply wouldn't know what's happening halfway across the world. And the other is we've become much softer. As I said earlier, we don't accept rape, pillage, and murder as natural and acceptable, which we did throughout much of history. And just one small story at the end. There was a man named Henri Dunant, a Swiss nobleman, who started the International Red Cross movement at the Battle of Solferino in 1865, I think, when he went and saw all of these wounded soldiers in the Napoleonic Wars who were, you know, dying slow, agonizing deaths. So he made a makeshift hospital in a tent with some of the local women and began to treat the wounded. And the historians have said that why did the Red Cross movement begin in the 19th century and not in the 16th century? And the answer is probably because life in 16th century Europe was so horrifyingly nasty, brutish, and short that nobody would feel sorry for a wounded soldier, because the average life expectancy was probably about 25 to 30 years of age. And disease, superstition, ignorance, random violence was such that there was no space for people to feel sorry about the wounded in war. So that's why I'm saying we shouldn't despair despite the horrible things that are happening, because they're horrible to us because our standards have changed. And I think that is reflected in the United Nations. despite all of its shortcomings. So there's a lot to recognize, just as there's a vast room for improvement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the moment when you were on the plane, a nine-year-old, trying to practice your few English phrases to unknown people here, known called Canadian, to the fluent, very polished English that you speak right now. It's a big journey. We have doctors, lawyers, engineers, second generation immigrants. They don't speak this English, not even close. What is your advice and recommendations for second generations to reach your level of English?
Well, thank you very much for your kind words. I really don't know how to answer it. I guess it's, 40 years of university and education will probably do that to most people. but it's interesting, I still have an accent, and a lot of people will detect it. So, and language is fascinating, because when I wrote the book, I said, okay, in 56 years of the Massey's, I'm the first person of Middle Eastern origin, so I should say something in my voice which reflects what how my reality may be different from other people's reality. So I realized that we take the English language and we appropriate it, and we make it Persian or we make it Indian. Look at Indian literature. The best Indian literature is in English, but it's written in Indian English. And as you know, my Indian friends, it's exactly the same, but completely different. So the use of language itself is quite phenomenal. And English, because it's the global language, has now become many different languages within which, because language ultimately is experiential. And I've been fascinated to speak English with people in Kenya, in Guyana, in Canada, in Ireland. We forget Irish. For the Irish, English is a second language. But my God, look at the Irish, giants of English literature. So language is a very interesting idea in its own right, and how we take ownership of the language.
After all these good movement happened in the region or in the country, all these violent evil become apparent. After that, we see all this thing, all the killing is happening. You said about what happened after Middle East Spring, even after we toppled the Shah. The question is, should we stop all those movements that is going to lead to freedom? Because what we see after all these democratic struggle to topple all those dictatorship, or what we really should do? The same thing at Yugoslavia. They, after all those freedom they gained, what is happening? We saw that then. That was the consequence of that, all those struggle that the people did, or what we did in Iran. So what is your suggestion? So what we should do?
Well, I think we need to understand the link between means and ends. And that's certainly one of the powerful lessons of history. As I said, every revolution has been in the name of a greater good, but we know how revolutions devour their children and leave us infinitely worse off in many, many instances. So I think that, let's think about the nationalist movement of Mahatma Gandhi as a historical example, or the example of Martin Luther King. And nonviolence, I think, is a way of linking means and ends. If you are the victim of hatred and violence, and you replicate the same hatred and violence as an instrument of liberation, it's probably not going to end well. I'm not saying that people don't have a right to defend themselves, but when you unleash hatred, that's the power of Nelson Mandela, the power of forgiveness. And if you read Long Walk to Freedom, he speaks about how when he was released from prison, he says, I felt I was going to a larger prison of hatred, so I decided to forgive. And that changed the course of history. South Africa could have descended into a brutal civil war. It didn't, because of leadership, because of moral vision and leadership, because of the understanding that means and ends are linked. So I think that we have a kind of adolescent immaturity about the idea, oh, we will have revolution and we will go out there and smash the evil fascists and we will have a better world. Guess what? That's not the way it works. The way it works is building culture from the bottom up. And that is the only way of bringing about lasting transformation. Top-down solutions, especially those imposed by violence, don't end up well. So I also think that there is an increasing understanding about that reality, that building culture is the most profound form of resistance, actually, because when our minds are colonized, then we're completely finished. I think colonization of the mind is much worse than physical violence and domination. So I think that some of the millennials, at least I teach in a university, I see people have this understanding.
Hello, I just want to say I really enjoyed your book, by the way. It was very insightful and inspiring. But one thing you mentioned in the book is that you harshly criticize some of these secular solutions to kind of stress and anxiety, like, for example, yoga or mindfulness apps and that kind of thing. but I was actually interested in kind of why, could you talk a bit more about why those are kind of shallow or inadequate kind of solutions? Because I think that actually is interesting, and I think it was.
No, I mean, obviously, I'm writing to a national audience, so I'm being rhetorical and playful with language. And what I'm trying to say is that spiritual salvation doesn't come from navel gazing and self-indulgence. It comes, yes, we need to contemplate, we need to reflect, and embrace our inner self. But ultimately, we need to go out there and connect with others. So we live in a hyper-connected world electronically, but we experience the most superficial of connections with each other. So I think, you know, Headspace app and yoga, and those are wonderful things, but not if we understand them in a self-indulgent way. You know, I think about, talking about Deepak Chopra, the way, for example, Rumi has become commercialized, right? These people have no idea what Rumi means. Rumi is about, you know, surrender of self, the death of the ego, and you take this crass, narcissistic Hollywood culture, which is so empty and void of meaning that it wants to hold on to whatever Kabbalism and mysticism in the most superficial way, but without changing the status quo, without changing anything. You want to be a mystic? Go to the bloody mountains. Give up your narcissism. Give up your greed. That is what spiritual transformation really is about. And that's why I'm saying that there is a contradiction. We are longing for meaning, but we don't want to do the hard work. So that's what I mean. So keep on practicing yoga. And
thank you very much for your talk. I just had a quick question, and you've touched on some of these points already. So we live in an interconnected world where everyone's connected with everyone else, and yet we're constantly, at least I've felt that we're constantly retreating into our echo chambers more and more frequently. Can you comment on how we bridge the gap of empathy and understanding between us and them, the familiar and the different, and break the cycle of pain that ultimately makes it so difficult for us to listen and hear and overcome, I guess, the struggles that we see in our world today?
Yes, we are losing the art of dialogue. And I think the proliferation of information and the media is clearly facilitating that. You know, a lot of people were outraged about my conversations with the suicide bomber, for example. They said, how can you humanize a suicide bomber? I said, I'm not humanizing anyone. I'm just writing what I saw, right? That's the reality. Or the war criminal that I write about in chapter 2, Dražen Erdemović, who executed all these people, but he didn't want to. And, you know, the complexities, the ambiguities, life is complicated. And I think that we're much better off understanding than judging. It's very easy to judge, very easy to throw stones and point fingers. Much more difficult to try and understand why do people say the things and do the things that they do, not because we necessarily accept it. So I think that if anything, those of us that want social progress, instead of retreating into this very self-indulgent political correctness where we think paying lip service to some progressive ideas makes us better people, we need to go out there in the trenches and speak to the people. One of the most wonderful things I think about Van Jones, who's at, you know, CNN, who's a, you know, friend of mine, and, you know, he's this, you know, black American who was so distraught when, you know, Trump was elected, and to see the racism in his country, And he went and did a number of interviews with Trump voters in the Midwest. And it was incredible to see why these people feel betrayed by the liberal elites, by the people that say all the right things, the Goldman Sachs of the world and whatever it is, you know, the people that feel that they've been forgotten, that they're being treated with complete indifference. And that's why I said that if we don't learn to connect with people's suffering, guess what? The extremists and the demagogues are going to push those buttons, because people don't think fundamentally intellectually. People think emotionally, which is not necessarily a bad thing if you have intelligent higher emotions as opposed to base instincts. And I just want to end by saying that we shouldn't imagine that very ugly things can't happen right here in Canada. In Quebec, where I live, Quebec City, in January, 6 Muslims were massacred in a mosque. They were gunned down, and then for several weeks, they couldn't find a cemetery that would accept their dead. Imagine that. And then sometime later, someone went and committed arson against the head of that, you know, particular mosque. And now we have Bill 62, as if there are no problems in Quebec, you know, that the biggest problem is whether women cover their face or not. You know, the 3 women in Quebec that wear the niqab are the source of all evil. We can forget about, you know, the corruption and the crumbling bridges and you know, all the incredible social ills. So that kind of demagoguery is right here in our own midst as well. And if our liberal elites, who say all the right things, yes, we're feminist, we're pro-indigenous, whatever, if they don't change a world in which the richest 8 people in the world have more wealth than the bottom 50%, 3.5 billion people in the world, you don't need to be a Nobel Prize winning economist to realize that's not going to end well. So that's why I'm saying the spiritualization of culture is transcending this pattern of greed, the sort of bottomless pit of our need for you know, consumption. And once we begin to spiritualize our discourse, we will have the meaningful conversations we need to have.
Thanks a lot for coming, and I am very happy I could make it to listen to your wonderful speech. Based on you have been in Rwanda and Bosnia, I am wondering whether with the very extreme effect of the being, you know, with those people and what has happened over there, have you ever come back to those countries, and whether you have followed some people's story? And even though, you know, I know you said you have had very hardship being there and emotionally and, you know, all together, whether have you gone back and followed the people's?
In my book, I tell the story of many people with whom I've developed lifelong friendships. And in my third chapter, I speak about my former student, Eloge Butera, who was a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. And that chapter is entirely his story of the day he walked into my office at McGill University, and he's now my adoptive brother. So I also try to convey in my book that although these are very terrible tragedies, there's also something incredibly beautiful and inspiring about the survivors I've met. My heroes are the survivors that I've met, people who've gone through unspeakable suffering, but who go on living and they show the resilience of the human spirit. So we shouldn't only think that, oh my God, it's so terrible, there's suffering, but you also see the most beautiful, amazing people. And also in this lecture tour that I had in Canada from the Yukon to Newfoundland, I met the most extraordinary people in Canada. So I think that the cynicism sometimes comes from self-indulgent, the chattering class, which likes to point fingers and say, oh my God, the world is so horrible. And my sort of challenge to them is, well, get up and do something about it. Don't think you're exempt. Nobody's exempt. And when you actually, you know, writing checks to charity is great, but when you actually become intimately involved in touching other people's lives, it's addictive in the best sense of the word. You would never live your life differently. So I, despite everything I've gone through, would not live my life any differently. And to have meaning and purpose in your life is worth, you know, more than anything.
Yeah, thanks for your wonderful speech. I enjoyed it a lot. Had a quick question. Since your speech and story was delivered in form of kind of chronological thing, you know, you said about what you did and then you realized that enough is enough and you came back, why not, you know, go to New York, you know, being a lawyer, make lots of money, and then 2001, that happened, you know, the September 11th. I am so interested to, it was kind of you cut it short, you know, and then you came to conclusion. I would like to hear quickly, I know time, after that, your personal experience, life, story, from that 2001 until today. Thanks so much.
I ended up leaving the law firm and going back to doing human rights work. And that's what that was my incredible experience. I needed to experience it. And I realized that, you know, once you've seen certain things, you can't unsee it. And once you give yourself enough space to heal and to, you know, have the strength to go back there, you realize, why would I want to do it any differently? As I said, I've met the most amazing people in my line of work, unsung heroes, the most extraordinary people. And I'm not talking about the heads of state and heads of government and billionaires and Hollywood celebrities. I'm talking about ordinary people who rise to the occasion and who have taught me the extraordinary resilience of the human spirit. Mona was my first teacher when I was 16, but she opened me to a journey where I met many, many others who made me understand what life is about. And that's why I come back and I see how in our society people are suffering from emptiness. This is the crisis that we have. We don't have enough meaning in our life. So there's a connection between our living meaningful lives by helping others and our own self-fulfillment and happiness. And at the end, yeah, I left the law firm. So
I have a very short question, that is there any difference between letting people to die and killing people? So if there is no difference between that, so what's our moral duty to stop like killing people as a Canadian? So what should be done to stop these killings all over the world? And and what's United Nations doing like to stop all these?
Sometimes, you know, being killed is not the worst thing that can happen to people. Sometimes dying a slow, painful death is much, much worse. So we have immense amounts of poverty and despair. And even in our own society where, you know, we don't have that kind of violence, but, you know, for someone that experiences, you know, severe distress, emotional distress, life can be a living hell. So I think we emphasize too much physical pain and we don't understand enough emotional and spiritual pain, which can be even worse in certain circumstances. And in terms of your answer about what the United Nations is doing, to say it very quickly, we have a system today of international law and institutions like the International Criminal Court and the UN Human Rights Council, which, while very defective, are still a reflection of the fact that the world has moved on. Today, we speak the language of international law and human rights and collective decision making. We may not do enough, but in a sense, we have no choice. And all of those people that say, oh, we want to retreat into our mother's womb, we don't want to be part of this world and the global problem, guess what? You can't go back to your mother's womb. It's too late. You have to grow up and deal with the world as an adult, and you need to solve your problems with all the others with whom you share the planet that is shrinking every day. So the United Nations, as I said, is just part of the picture. And ultimately, real change doesn't happen overnight. Real change happens through generations, through historical struggles. That's why I'm saying that our choices matter. Our indifference matters. The wonderful saying is that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Once we understand that every single act of radical evil in the world has happened because small elites have hijacked the masses, then we begin to understand the importance of our voice. And whether it's the neighbor giving cupcakes to their next door neighbor, or how we treat our colleagues at work and how we choose to become engaged in public issues and to educate ourselves. There's not one magic formula. There are many, many different levels at which we need to become engaged.
I wanted to know that what type of barriers or causes do you think that prevents us from thinking about the others and caring of otherness? What sort of idea dictates us reject the others?
I would say the materialistic conception of human nature. You know, if as I said, if our idea is human beings are fundamentally greedy and selfish, and our whole economic system is about how much can I consume, to hell with everyone else, it's not going to end well. It's not going to bring out our higher nature, our higher self. And that's why I'm saying I've seen these extremes of human potentiality. I've seen the capacity for radical evil, but I've also seen the capacity for incredible heroism and nobility. And that was maybe the story of the teenage suicide bomber. He could just as well have been a medical doctor. And he turns out to be a suicide bomber. And what is it that makes people make those choices? So just to maybe explain it, when we look at the 1980s, the rise of neoliberal economics, I was brought up in the days of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, the neoliberal revolution, where the idea was, and you know, it's interesting, we're speaking in a church. For most of history, greed was seen as a moral transgression, as a sin. In the 1980s, it became a policy objective. And sort of deregulation and hyper-consumption became the idea of, you know, the utopia, that this is how we're going to achieve the good society, through revolutionary shopping. And now, 30, 40 years later, the planet is on the brink of ecological collapse. We have unprecedented social injustice, which is giving rise to demagogical fascist movements, as it has throughout history. On top of that, we are experiencing, in the midst of abundance and affluence, this sort of collective sense of despair and groping in the darkness to find meaning through these kind of superficial demonstrations of virtue, which I was talking about. So all this to say that there's a reason why we are today. We have had a series of what I think are false assumptions about the purpose of society, about the purpose of human existence, and we're going to have to dig our way out, either by learning the hard way or by having the vision and correcting our path.
My question for you is that did you ever like touch upon the role, the impact of religion in your book? Like it's ironic that I have to like bring it up here at the church, but we know that so many atrocities have been committed throughout the history by the name of religion. And right now there's so many still happening by the name of, for example, Islam. And I'm not talking about the misinterpretation of the religious books and texts, but I'm just talking about the religion itself. Mm-hmm. Because I would just talk about Islam, and I've read so many like Islamic books and all that, and the violence is there. So do you touch upon that at all?
I address it at many, many different levels, because I think it's fundamental. First of all, from a sort of etymological point of view, or from the point of view of popular discourse, I would make a distinction between religion and spirituality. And I love what Rumi said, that in every religion there is love, but love has no religion. And I think if we understand the difference between a transcendent spirituality and narrow-minded dogmatism, which is, collective narcissism, then that's one point of departure. So being critical of religious dogmatic superstition doesn't mean that the answer is a culture of materialism, which is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The other point is that let's look at the record of what I call in my book substitute religions. As I explained, in Western civilization, with the Enlightenment decline of Christianity, we had ideologies which were in effect substitute religions. It's remarkable to look at the writings of Karl Marx and the biblical imagery that he has, the whole idea of the Garden of Eden, you know, the primitive communist society that he writes about, and you know, the forbidden fruit being the division of labor, and a lot of fantastic works have been written about the social psychology of Marx and the way it was influenced by Judeo-Christian eschatology. So I think that there's this incredible arrogance in the tradition of the Enlightenment that we are so intellectual that we can rise above our own self, that we're on top of the world rather than a part of it. So I think that that arrogance, that lack of humility, is itself part of the reason why we've had these catastrophic ideologies, which have been far worse than religion in their toll. Once you begin to substitute abstractions and you begin to sacrifice people's lives in the name of some abstract good without understanding in an intimate way the spiritual interconnectedness that we all have towards each other, it will never end well. So I'm anti-ideology, but that doesn't mean that I'm politically indifferent. I just think that we need to re-examine our idea of political change. It was the question the gentleman asked before as well, that you know, all revolutions come with a great message, but they end up in a bloody mess. So I think we need to rediscover, as postmodern, highly intelligent society, with all the benefits of science and technology, we need to rediscover our mystical self. And I could call it mystical self, others would call it, I don't know, psychological health, or whatever the case, some people will call it empathy. It doesn't matter how you speak about it. It doesn't matter whether you're a devout believer or an atheist. As long as in substance we are in touch with that deeper self, which is what distinguishes us from the animals, which is what makes us care and help others. I don't care what you call it, where you find inspiration, as long as we realize that that is the root of why we will choose to use our science and technology and capabilities for good rather than evil.
Well, thank you very much, Payam.
Thank you.